Well, good morning. It is wonderful to be here this morning. We are looking at lesson 10, and it's titled Modernity and Fundamentalism. Some big words, but don't be scared by that. A lot of things to discuss, but before we get started, I just want to mention, thank you for leading that song there, Brent. It actually goes very well with our lesson, and just the whole message of love. I'm really looking for a lot of discussion today with this, because the issues that are being faced are, there's a lot of different ways you can come out on it. And as that song that we sang in verse 1, it said, "At first I prayed for light that I might know the way." And it's a picture of this person just wanting, oh, this is the right thing to do, and this is the right thing to do, and oh, God told me this, and all this stuff. But then, I believe it's verse 3, he says, "But now I pray for love." And verse 4, he says, "God waited patiently until I prayed that larger prayer. I stopped asking him all this technicality, all I need to know, all this stuff. And now I say, God, give me love, so that I may serve you and show, be your hands and feet." And I believe that is so important as we look at today's lesson. Is probably not going to be finishing up this lesson and have the answers to all this stuff. But what I want us to think about is, what are we motivated by? What is our reason for doing what we are doing? And anyway, before we get started, let's pray. Father, thank you for another beautiful day that you've made, and your promise of the continued seasons. And just thank you that you are faithful, and you are our guide and truth, our perfect example of love. And as we study this lesson and look at history, help us to open our minds to what you are telling us, not to what we are trying to justify, but to completely surrender to what you are telling us to do, as we are to be examples of your love to the world around us. In your name, amen. So, before I dive into the lesson, how many of you could describe for me what an echidna is? Wonderful. Only one person. So, if I can pick on Brent, I did not talk to him before this, about this, but Brent, could you tell us what an echidna is? By telling us what is not.
It's not a bird.
It's not a bird. Okay, great. What else?
It is not a reptile.
Not a reptile.
It is not an object.
How many of you are any closer to knowing what an echidna is now than you were before? It's ever so slightly. Now, can you tell us what it is?
It's a, it's a mammal that kind of is like a hedgehog, but it lays eggs.
Yeah. How many of you actually have kind of a picture in your mind now? There we go. Got a few more people. So, that is what I want to take into this lesson. We're going to see that ideology, and thank you, Brent, for being vulnerable there. That's the ideology that's coming up multiple times in this lesson, is, are we defining things by what they are not? Are we motivating ourselves by what we are not trying to be, or are we motivating ourselves, and are we answering the why question for what we are to do? And I think that's a big part. It's important to have that outlook as we look at this lesson today. So, if you have your books, we're on page 104, looking at the modern era. Now, what is the modern era? So this is 1800s, 1900s. Rewind a little bit. So we've been looking at a lot of the political scene over the past two lessons. This lesson, we are looking more at the scientific realm of things. In coming out of the Dark Ages, in the 1500s, 1600s, we had the beginning of what we call today the beginning of modern science. And in defining modern science, we had men such as William Harvey, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, Sir Francis Bacon. These men all, for the most part, had a belief in God. And in the Middle Ages, a lot of the approach towards science, and especially health, was very superstitious. And not much of it was founded on reality. And the scientific thinking coming out of the Dark Ages, 1500s, 1600s, was a push towards observing reality. A lot of the teachers in colleges at this time, they would tell their students whenever they would release for summer break, they'd say, go out to nature and observe. Draw pictures, like observe reality and find conclusions off of that. And in our minds, it's like, well, of course, just do that. But this was kind of a new thing around this time. William Harvey, he was discovering the whole circulation of blood in the human body. They did not understand that before. Other men like this, they were discovering truths about nature, about the human body, that had never been known before, about disease, because there was this push towards, let's actually look at what is around us and observe it. But now we start getting into the 1800s, and we have Charles Lyell promoting, this idea was around before, but he very much promoted it, the idea of uniformitarianism, which says, essentially, the present is the key to the past. All of our natural processes that occur today have been occurring at that same rate since the Earth came into existence. This influenced Charles Darwin in writing The Origin of Species, in which he applied uniformitarianism to biological evolution and said, okay, so this gradual change of organisms contributed to complete species evolving. So this is mid-1800s to 1900s, and as your book has, in the late 1800s, and specifically in 1882, Nietzsche, a German philosopher, pronounced, God is dead. So, before this time, there was, for the most part, a widely accepted view of God and the Bible. And accepting him as, and accepting creation, accepting that he made the world. Not entirely, but overall, that was the mindset. We're getting into the late 1800s, early 1900s, and this whole cultural shift is going to man. And what man is doing. And we especially see that into the the Industrial Revolution in the late 1800s, beginning early 1900s, as many inventions are taking place. There's this deep focus on, look at what man is achieving, look at what man is inventing. And this starts beginning affecting the church as well. Theologians start questioning core beliefs of, your book has some here. Denying Jesus' divinity, denying miracles, analyzing the scriptures as badly flawed human documents. And I want to focus on this, look at this paragraph here on page 105, about in the middle. It says, at first, these changes affected Anabaptist groups in practical ways. Should we use electricity? Should we switch from horse-drawn vehicles to cars? Should we use tractors? How do we supply work for our growing children if father takes a job away from home? Is it all right to purchase clothing made by the world? So we see a lot of change, but what I want to stop and ask a little bit is, let's look at these questions. Now, what are some questions about change, especially looking at the inventions? Today, there's a lot of change happening. In inventions. So what are some questions today that are very similar to these but are more applying for today regarding us and adoption of some new technology? Can we just name a few questions? Should we fill in the blank?
Some more modern one, and two, but that's some of the things in the past. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, there we go. Virtual church. Very good. So once again, we could discuss these questions for a long time. And people are going to come out on a whole bunch of different places. But I don't want to look at this time period from the wrong perspective. But I do want to highlight danger when we focus primarily on this type of question. Because, I guess maybe I should just ask that. What are some dangers with asking this type of question? Or putting a lot of emphasis on this type of question of, oh, should I do this or should I do this? Should I accept this? Whenever we have changes in the world, what are some dangers with highlighting this type of question? And maybe really just focusing it and finding, hopefully that question is clear. Or maybe you don't think there's any danger there. Thank you. And yeah, do not get me wrong. I think we do need to discuss these things. But once again, it goes back to what I was mentioning at the beginning. What is our outlook as we're discussing these questions? How are we, what's our motivation behind it? And feeling for these people at this time, there's just so much new stuff. Going from a widely accepted view of God, like for me, most of us, we've been born into America when it's been quite openly heathen and against God. So we're all kind of used to that immediately. But these people, most of them were probably born when it was widely accepted of God. And now all of a sudden this whole culture is changing around them. And they're really wrestling with this stuff of, oh, how should we be responding here? So, not wanting to criticize them, but just taking a look at it, is whenever the world is changing, whenever the world changes drastically, if it shakes our own practices a lot, maybe we need to reexamine why are we doing what we're doing? How much should the world's change of culture and practices affect ourselves? Anyway, going on to fundamentalism, page 106. This is coming out of this whole modern era, or this is how a lot of people were responding to it. And fundamentalists, they had a lot of good to say. They made a lot of good points. But there were two phrases that I really noticed in this entire section. And the one says, to stop the erosion of faith, conservative pastors and theologians from various denominations attempted to articulate basic premises of the Christian faith. And I noticed the reasoning there. To stop the erosion of faith, they did this. And then another paragraph, it says, in an attempt to resist acculturation, leaders in the Mennonite General Conference urged all churches to enforce regulations for members. So again, we see an overall response here, in order to stop this, in order to not go here, in order to stop going here. And not that what they were saying was bad, but I wonder how different this would look. I took those same phrases and I replaced them with very similar words, but from the opposite perspective. How different would it change these statements if we said, instead of saying to stop the erosion of faith, we'd say, in order to strengthen the faith of the believers, we did this. Or instead of saying, in an attempt to resist acculturation, we would say, in an effort to be more conformed to the image of Christ. We're going here. But anyway, we see a lot of this. I don't know. The picture I see with how they're responding to this is the world is turning evil, and we're just trying to, okay, we don't want to be a part of this. We don't want to be identified with all this stuff. And they're drawing very definite lines for their churches, for what, especially their practices, so that they are separate and that they keep their values, which is great. Like, they see this preservation, which is wonderful, of preserving purity, preserving good things. But there is very much of this outlook on, we're just trying not to go here. We're trying not to go along with this. And it's really sad. At the end of the last paragraph there, it says, in the mid-1940s, after increasing controversy over the lack of enforcement, conference leaders backed away from promoting conference-wide regulations, delegating that responsibility to regional conferences and district leaders. Over the next decades, this resulted in a general shift toward acculturation, which in turn caused many churches to withdraw and organize new conferences and fellowships. So the very thing that the fundamentalists started off trying to keep their churches from doing, which is acculturation, which is becoming like the culture around you, their whole motivation at the beginning was to prevent this from happening. And after all these steps, that's what happened anyway. Once again, going back to what is our motivation? I believe if our motivation is to not be something, well, even as we saw, as Brian was sharing with us this morning, in 1 Corinthians 13, there are quite a few statements in there in what he says what it is not. It says love is, it is patient, it is kind, it does not envy, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. But the motivation to love comes from all of the statements that say to do something and what it is. The statements that say what it's not, it helps clarify what it is, but the motivation to do it always comes from clarifying what you are supposed to do through it all. Anyway, does anybody have any questions or comments at this point? What are you thinking? Want some discussion here? Maybe you have some pushback to some of what I'm saying. Thank you. Taking a look there at higher education. This section starts off with the, for most of their history, and I like that they said for most of their history instead of not all of their history. For most of their history, Mennonites had been farmers and tradesmen working with their hands and seeing no need for education beyond the basics. Although in the early colonial period, because of the importance they placed on the Bible, Mennonites taught their children to read more than most colonists. But in the late 1800s, some Mennonites began attending Moody Bible Institute as well as other colleges. And it'd be really interesting to discuss, when did this change? Because the men who started the whole Anabaptist movement were highly educated men. They, especially on doctrinal and theological bounds, they could express their faith. They knew how to make statements. And I think maybe in some ways the persecution of the Mennonites and Anabaptists caused a lot of just departure away from higher education, not because they didn't want it, but because it just simply was not even available. You're living your life in hiding. You were not allowed to attend certain schools. So I think some of this life came just out of necessity, of just surviving. And probably through some of the fundamentalism then, they started taking some of these values and maybe defining themselves as, oh, we are these simple people who don't pursue this higher education thing. And I really want to clarify some of this, and maybe we can discuss some of this. How, how should we as Christians view, maybe not the term higher education because we immediately think college and school, how should we as Christians view just knowledge in general? And wanting to learn, how does Christ want us to view that in our lives? Does he want us as Christians to just be, oh, people who hardly know anything? Does he want us to be people who are actively always searching to learn more, searching to learn more about his creation, to express our faith better, to know him more? At least whenever I read the Bible, that's what I see in the Bible is. Seek me, strive for more. Nature declares the glory of God. Seek to learn about it and see me through it. And Solomon has a lot to say about wisdom and knowledge. He says it's to be sought far more than rubies and gems. And the sad thing that oftentimes comes from, if I dare say, some of the Mennonite anti-education mindset is, oh, we don't need to be educated, but the whole focus or reasoning for it is, just work and get a job and make money. When you read Proverbs, Solomon very clearly says, wisdom and knowledge is to be sought more than rubies and precious money. And so you see a difference there. And so I'm definitely not approaching this with this, college and whatnot. No, I'm looking at this as how does God want us to respond to this? The love of learning, the love of knowing more and seeking him. But what's so important is Solomon says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And I believe that's some of what we see happening here with this whole acculturation, especially in the colleges and schools over this time. God is being pulled out. And so I believe there's a rightful fear of they see this higher education as teaching against God, against what the truth of the Bible, against Jesus' divinity, and maybe wrongfully putting that on the higher education and seeing higher education as a problem, when in reality it was because God was removed from it. Some of these, there were some Mennonite colleges made, and these men listed here, I have not read a lot of these men. Well, actually, most of them, I have not read their works. But I do know Harold S. Bender. And I believe most of these men, their works were highly, highly accurate to how God wants us to live as Christians. And these men were in some ways not accepted entirely because people questioned their whole pursuit of higher education. But these were men, they could articulate their faith and their beliefs. And I believe they pursued this higher education with a very much God in focus, and really being able to stand up to these professors and talk to them on a higher level of, no, this is this whole ideology of uniformitarianism and whatnot, being able to stand against that. For me, I know I would even struggle some, and I want to learn more on that, but it's like Jesus says to be able to give an answer to him that asks of the hope that's in you. And anyway, I think the biggest thing in this point is I would just really, let's not blame higher education for something that is just an absence of God. I believe that happens sometimes. And as Christians, we should just long to know more and more about God's creation. And all for the purpose of, well, first of all, loving God and loving our neighbor. 1914, World War I began. As the book says, conscientious objection was not really allowed at all. There was no grounds made. You couldn't even pay for a substitute like you used to be able to from the Civil War previous years and wars. So many of them, even though offered non-combatant services, we don't have time to read stories, but there are, if you have a chance, read some of the actual stories that happened over this time. I remember some of the first times that I read those stories, I never knew that America had done that. very literal persecution over this time against these men. And once again, whenever we read, at least for me, whenever I read the first part of this whole section, it's like, okay, this is good that they're not fighting, but reading this all back to back with the previous sections of fundamentalism, it's kind of like, okay, how are they approaching this not fighting? Are they refusing to do this just because, oh, like, I'm not supposed to fight, I'm not supposed to kill? But what's so beautiful is the next last paragraph says, Mennonites further demonstrated their values immediately after World War I, when some 50 young Mennonites joined the American Friends Service Committee in reconstruction work in the war-stricken lands of Europe. They also raised over $360,000 to support this work. What a testimony. And for myself, I am completely on par with not going to war. But once again, with everything that we've been discussing earlier, if our reasoning for not going to war is simply because Jesus told us not to kill, I think we're off our mark. Because, I mean, that's a pacifist. Pacifist just doesn't want to kill. What is our motivation for not doing this? Or what is our motivation for, Jesus said, to love our enemies? Jesus said to serve and view others more highly than ourselves. And if these 50 young Mennonites would not have done this right after World War I, imagine how differently that would have impacted the people around them. It would have been, oh, these people are just not one to fight, and this is, they're not one to help at all. But as soon as there was something where they could love and help, they were fully in behind it. And what a testimony, especially Brian's message this morning of loving. What a testimony to people around them of, they saw that these young people were not going to war, were refusing to fight, and they were persecuting them for it. But as soon as there was an opportunity to show love, they were all in behind and wanting to do that. Anyway, thank you for your discussion. And as I said, a lot of controversial things in this lesson. And thank you.